Hi guys, just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest guy Kelly, all about the world's worst novelty songs, Ben and I are here together!
Hello!
Look, listen, I was about to say, look, you obviously can't. We're on the same screen as one another, recording an intro, because we have an anniversary coming up, a birthday. I don't know what 250th anniversary is. Obviously, people don't live that long, so the people who come up with the weird wedding gift lists haven't had to exhaust that.
I imagine it's degraded plutonium.
Your neutron star anniversary. Anyway, we are not very far away from hitting the 250th episode of Worst Foot Forward, which is, fuck me, that's a lot of our life.
Yeah, it's too much of our lives.
Yeah, and as a result, we thought, what's the best way we can mark such a weird little milestone in our creative careers? And we turn to you to help us create that content. Do the work for us, we say. We'll have recorded 249 episodes plus bonus things and live streams and all sorts of other things. And so for our 250th, we are doing a call out for your own favourite trivia. If you want to get in touch with us via email on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com, we would love any and all of you to send in either written down your favourite failure facts from the podcast history or ones that we haven't mentioned, personal failures, international failures, historical failures, prehistoric failures, failures from the animal world, and we will compile them and curate them and read them out on the show. Or if you feel confident and, crucially, have decent enough audio recording equipment or a quiet enough room to record in, why not you record us a little 30-second snippet of you reading out a fact? Again, we'll listen to them, we'll put a few of them into the show, we'll maybe do some further research around them and all of that. And so we'll create a little community episode to celebrate 250 hours plus of trivia and terribleness. You know, to celebrate the fact that we've created a podcast that we love, but also celebrate the fact that there's so many of you out there who seem to like what we do and who are very nice to each other on our Discord and Twitter and to us. So it'd be nice to get you involved. What's the other housekeeping we have to do?
I mean, the usual shenanigans. Thank you as ever for helping us keep the lights on by going to patreon.com/worstfootforward and donating money to us. But like, do you know what? This week, bollocks to that. Don't give us any money. Give it to some humanitarian causes for people in Ukraine, because they absolutely need it more than us. Or indeed, people in Yemen, who are also victims of illegal war with weapons given to them to their oppressors by the British government. Basically, give loads of money to the International Red Cross or Amnesty International, and not these two schmoes. But if you do want to help these two schmoes, go to your podcatcher of choice, preferably iTunes, and give us a 5-star review, because that will get our podcast into other ears, where it belongs. There you go, the usual mixture of egocentrism, self-interest, and a little bit of altruism there.
Exactly, what you've come to expect from us. The email address, as ever, is worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Like I say, if you want to help us compile our 250th episode, send your facts to us there, and you can get in touch with us on Twitter as usual on @worstfoot. Ben is on @BenVandeveld, and I'm on @BazMaxDay. And a shout out to our little Discord community as well. If you want to sign up on Discord and chat to other Worst Foot Forward listeners, you can do that by using the link in the podcast description below. Now, strap in. We're very sorry in advance for all of the earworms we're about to unleash into your ears over the next hour or so, and enjoy this episode with Guy Kelly, all about the world's worst novelty songs.
I know a song that'll get on your nerves, get on your nerves, get on your nerves. Hi, everybody, join in, come on.
That's literally as much of that as we're allowed to sing, both monetarily and humanitarily.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry MacStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of World's Worst Something. All together now, you put your worst foot in, your other foot in, you turn on the wood chipper and you scream in pain, you do the worst foot forward and your limbs get chipped, and that's what it's all about. And alongside me is the hokey to my cokey, the lost to my ketchup, and the push pineapple to my grind coffee. It's Ben van der Velde.
And a very crazy frog to you too, my friend.
I have a funny feeling that this episode will have a quite a strong, like, English-speaking world divide with the rest of our Alistairs in the rest of the world.
It could well do well, because one man's novelty song is another man's incredibly artful piece of music making. And the last thing I want to do is go in with a two-footed challenge on someone who I think is laughable, but is actually Guatemala's answer to Paul McCartney.
Yeah. Remember you talked about that guy who sang the song in Italy in the early 70s, which was a novelty song where it was parodying American rock.
Yes.
And it was a complete nonsense song.
Oh, Prison Cool in Incident Sousa.
That chap, yes. And we talked about World's Worst Language because he made up a language. But obviously, you know, it could have also fit into this category as well.
It's remarkable. I mean, I think the best parody of rock and roll has been done by Mick Jagger. Because with every passing day, I look at the Rolling Stones as nothing other than a high-end tribute band.
To the Rolling Stones.
Well, yes, firstly to the Rolling Stones, and then, yeah, more importantly, to Muddy Waters.
And you know what? As a shy and, at the time, closeted teenager, the novelty song was my respite at a school disco, because a lot of novelty songs have an inbuilt dance, mm-hmm, whether it's Saturday Night or the Macarena or Pizza Hut or any of those ones. So what you felt on safe ground as someone who was uncomfortable in their body and mind in terms of, I can dance to this because there's rules.
Yep, I get that. I mean, whereas I love all sorts of different kinds of music, but I love the indie disco, because the thing about the indie disco is generally the songs are telling a story, and so I could just act out the story. It's like, yes, that, or the beauty of funk and reggae is if you look ridiculous whilst you're dancing to it, then you're doing it correctly.
And also a lot of funk and reggae dances, like, you do your head, you do the dancing like you're swaying to side to side with your head, your eyes firmly fixed on the ground in front of you, so you don't have to make eye contact.
Yes. Often, if I was dancing to reggae, eye contact is the last thing that would be in my adult mind. My approach to dancing was either act out the songs or try and be the Mr. Soft Man from that Mint advert.
Yes! Who looks like, for people who don't remember that Trebor ad from the 90s,
yeah,
looks like those blow-up men who are used to sell used cars in America.
Oh, I was going to suggest he looks like the Michelin Man after he's melted.
That's true.
Our guest this week is a writer, actor, sketch performer, former maze master at the Crystal Maze, fictional restaurant reviewer, murder mystery impresario, freelance game journalist, and, in the words of AV Club, an insane genius. He is the answer to the question, what would happen if Prince Charming was constantly on a bourbon hangover and had read too much H.P. Lovecraft? Please welcome the dashing, unhinged, sophisticated, mad, bad, and great fun to know, Lord Guy Kelly.
Oh, stop it. Hello, folks. How are you doing? I am delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. You're looking very dashing.
I'm still not sure about the moustache. I look like a sort of Wish.com Tom Selleck, and I really don't know whether to keep it or not. This is the boredom of facial hair. I've just spent the last 2 years shaving different bits of me into different shapes,
yeah,
to see whether I'm still recognisably human.
I'm pretty certain that the boredom of facial hair won Richard and Judy's Book of the Year in 2018.
I don't know, because you've done a lot of streaming and stuff over lockdown. So you do Twitch, you do the crossword on Twitch, is that right?
A couple of years ago, I decided to start solving cryptic crosswords on Twitch, the video game live streaming service, because, you know, that's what you want to watch when you're tired of watching people shout thinly veiled racial slurs during a game of Fallout. You want to watch a man who doesn't really like cryptic crosswords spending up to 3 hours attempting to solve one with increasing frustration.
I was expecting that you were going to be a master of them, because I find cryptic crosswords infuriating, and I think having someone talk me through the steps of how it works, I'd actually find very satisfying and actually quite soothing.
I do talk people through the steps of how they work once I've got them. It's the sort of thing, though, once I've managed to spend 25 minutes holding my head in my hands going, just words mean things. Words mean things. You can't just say this and mean something. There are rules. Like, eventually, when it all filters through, I can then start explaining, oh, this bit's an anagram. Oh, this bit's a weird bit of bridge notation, because cryptic crossword setters love bridge because they're all from the 1950s. Yeah. It's bewildering, but I've got a really nice audience, like a lovely bunch of really inclusive and diverse people drop in to watch a man suffer. I could have chosen something that I like, but then I realised I'm not sure I like anything. And so I'd just be sitting there blinking in affable silence until I decided it was time to stop streaming.
I'm sure out there is a university thesis which is, in many ways, weren't crosswords the first video games?
I think the reason I got to cryptic crosswords is because I like puns. Mm. There's a part of my brain, I've described it as like, you know when you run Task Manager, or you open Task Manager on your computer, and you can see all of the different processes that are running. There are some that you recognise, and then there's some that's just a series of letters and numbers that looks like an aggressive person's Twitter username.
Yeah.
And I'm fairly sure if you were to run that on my brain, there'd be something permanently in the background looking at everything that I do, say, or see, to try and find a pun for it. And when I realised that cryptic crosswords were sort of weaponized puns written by and for smug pricks, I was like, well, I'm a smug prick.
So what you're saying is that the likes of Andy Zaltzman and Stuart Francis look at cryptic crosswords the way my maths genius wife looks at the Sudoku. Andy Zaltzman solves cryptic crosswords in the way that savant 12-year-olds solve 15 Rubik's Cubes at the same time.
Yeah, it's like Neo looking through the Matrix.
Yeah, yeah. If you thought I was bad, folks, strap in for the next hour with Guy on the podcast.
Oh, God, yeah. Neo looking at the Matrix, but instead of bullets, it's wordplay. Yeah.
Well, we've discovered that you're very good at, as you say, weaponizing wordplay. What are you not so good at? What's your worst at in the world?
So it's going to sound like I'm a conceited prick. So I'm just putting this out there because I'm then going to immediately explain why. I am terrible at failing things. I can't do things badly. Not in the sense that everything I touch turns to gold. Quite the opposite. Everything I touch turns to shit. But I'm bad at failing in the sense that if I do something and it doesn't go well, I will never do that thing again. Oh, an wow. example, I, much like every other living human being on the planet, started playing about with Wordle because an incomprehensible series of emojis appeared in my Twitter feed, and I'm a curious creature, and I wanted that little hit of dopamine that everyone else is getting. Mm. Did Wordle, couple of weeks, had a lovely time. Got my first failure, never touched it again. Fuck you, Wordle. Fuck you. I was really enjoying it as well, like it was a lovely thing to do. And as soon as I got that first failure, it's like, well, simply never doing this again. No, thank you. That applies to singing. You were talking about dancing in the intro. I know I can't dance. And so the idea of dancing where other people can see me and doing it wrong, I would rather die. The amount of weddings, including my own, that I've just stood sullenly in the background waiting for it to finish. I think that might be an ADHD thing and a sort of rejection sensitivity thing. Mm. Or it might be that I'm just difficult. But if there's anything that requires like sketching, doodling, I'm never gonna doodle in a meeting because I can't draw. No, I'll just grip my pen really firmly in my hands. So when I say that I'm terrible at failing, please don't think that it means I'm competent. It means exactly the opposite.
Yes, no, don't let that drive you away from Guy's Twitch channel if that's what you want to see.
Yeah. Oh, if you want to watch 3 hours of consecutive failure, twitch.tv/brainmage. That is your place.
Love it. Like, from your point of view, the Samuel Beckett quote should be, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, make a sandwich.
Well, this week, at Guy's suggestion, we are talking about the world's worst novelty song. It's probably just as well we don't have, you know, the rights to play a lot of music, because this could be, if it was a compilation show, could turn into the most hellish Monday morning commute for our listeners. So no, we will spare you the clips, but nevertheless, Ben, you're going to dive into the secondhand record store and see what you come up with.
Now, there's only one place that we can start when we're talking about novelty songs. Songs that are sometimes good, but are often the sort of earworms that you will only find underneath the foliage in the darkest parts of the Amazon. And the moment you pick up that worm, it burrows into the top of your cranium and starts eating your brain. Mm. Which artist am I talking about, Barry and Guy? The Beatles. That is where we're starting. Because it is the ones that you love that hurt you the most. I'm going to tell you about their most infamous unreleased track. At the end of 1966, start of 1967, they were at their most arty and experimental. They had just recorded Revolver. They go on to make Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which obviously you don't need me to tell you how brilliant it is, but even at the mention of it, there are still several Rolling Stone journalists who have sensed a disturbance in the force and have started jacking off at the very thought of that album. Paul McCartney is the driving force behind it, but McCartney has this chip on his shoulder that he's not considered the avant-garde one because he likes writing all of these cozy vaudevillian songs about grandmothers and being 64 and meeting a maid called Rita, and that Lennon really was the avant-garde one. And actually, they both were. The difference was, I guess, that Paul was still sort of chirpy and cheery and John was smacked out of his brains and yowling into the ether. The most avant-garde thing that John made got onto the White Album, Revolution No. 9, which it is 9 minutes of cut and paste, bits of classical music and babies crying and the sound of... I really should know who it is. It feels like it's George Martin, but it's not. It's just saying number nine, number nine, number nine, over and over. For what it is, it's quite good. But that's not the novelty song. The one I'm going to talk about is Carnival of Light. And this was commissioned for something called the Million Volt Light and Sound Rave, which was held at the Roundhouse in London between the 28th of January and the 4th of February 1967. So, and the Roundhouse is now one of the best music venues in town, and indeed was then. And at the time, McCartney was hanging out with an awful lot of avant-garde composers and innovators, and he was fascinated with people like John Cage, who we've talked about a lot before.
Friend of the show, probably now. We're probably a friend of the show, John Cage.
Yeah, absolutely. And he wears that badge with pride.
It doesn't have anything written on it, though.
No. The badge is attached to his uniform without a pin.
Yeah.
This was an event where sort of happenings were occurring. What Paul wanted to do was make the most avant-garde thing he could. The biggest inspiration for this was the BBC radiophonic workshop worker and synthesizer pioneer, a man called Peter Zinoviev. McCartney went to meet him at his house in Putney, and he played him an experimental composition that, according to another member there, was played at such intense decibel frequencies that many parts of my anatomy, including internal organs, began to perform an involuntary dance I can only describe as ecstatic twitching. And so Paul took this notion back to the studio, and this is when they were getting ready to write Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields, A Day in the Life. And he said to the Beatles, all I want you to do is just wander around all the stuff, bang it, shout, play it, doesn't need to make any sense, hit a drum, then wander onto the piano, hit a few notes, wander around. And they basically performed this incredibly indulgent 15-minute freak out.
There are very few things that make my heart sink quite as much as the term from the 1960s, an artistic happening. And this sounds like a drama school workshop that's just been recorded and called art.
Two favourite things about it. Mark Lewisohn, who is one of the great Beatles biographers, has managed to strip it back to four essential parts. So track one is a distorted hypnotic drum and organ sound. Track two, a distorted lead guitar. Track three, the sounds of a church organ, various effects including gargling, and voices, in particularly John and Paul screaming at each other the phrases, are you all right, and Barcelona.
So far, this sounds like a recording that just takes place between a row of student houses, and if you just left a dictaphone there, the combined noise of everyone's telly parties, yeah, and pissed up arguments.
Pretty much. My favourite bit is track four, various indescribable sound effects with heaps of echo and manic tambourine. I don't think tambourine should ever be manic.
I don't think tambourine is capable of being anything other than manic.
Yeah.
Darling, I'm going to serenade you with the tambourine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Erotic tambourine is rather tricky to play. It didn't go down well with the Beatles. George Harrison didn't enjoy the avant-garde. Apparently he had a joke where he'd go, "Paul, you avant-garde a clue." Which it really shows why George outsourced his comedy to Monty Python. George Martin basically considered it unworthy of release. And when the anthology came out in the mid-90s, every single person involved, George Martin and his son, Giles, Yoko Ono, Ringo Starr, George Harrison, all vetoed Paul sticking it on the anthology. but my favourite response is from John Lennon, who said, "Avant-garde is French for bullshit."
Wow.
That's one temptation. Next, we go to Holland in 1978. A Dutch comedian called Joep van der Hik, which sounds like half a name that's spoken during a bout of the hiccups. It's a song called Flappy.
Just already, I hate it. Just already.
It's about a boy who's angry with his father for cooking their family's pet rabbit at Christmas.
I mean, fair play. He's got a point.
Yeah, he does have a point. This song is now part of the Christmas annual rotation since 2003. And it's considered a bit of a Dutch classic. However, it's so popular, there have been numerous cases of vandals breaking into rabbit cages around Christmas time with the intention of stealing the rabbit and recreating parts of the Flappy lyrics. There are even people... You know how in Britain there's the whole, a dog is not just for Christmas, it's for life? Yeah. Well, apparently there's had to be a Dutch campaign based around that, but for rabbits, so that people don't steal and cook a rabbit.
This sounds like something from the middle of the Satanic Panic sort of years.
Yeah.
You know, the heavy metal people are trying to recreate these and summon Satan, but they're trying to summon Santa.
Yeah, in 2006, the Dutch Animal Protection League made a statement saying that anyone who wants to adopt a rabbit would have to wait until January. I mean, to be fair, the rabbits must be thinking, listen, you can adopt me in January, February, and March. If you adopt me in December, you're going to eat me. If you adopt me in April, you're going to fuck me.
Like we're used to hearing Last Christmas or whatever over here every year. Yep. At Christmas, that's on there. So did they have like Flappageddon as well, like we have Whamageddon?
They must do. I quite like him as Dutch comedians go, which I'll level with you is a fairly low bar, but his...
Well, yeah, everything's flat there.
In 1989, at his end of year show, he ridiculed something called Buckler, which is a low alcohol beer brewed by Heineken. And as a result, the sales plummeted and the brand was eventually withdrawn from the market. And Van der Hik has said that this is the best joke in his career. And I've got a lot of time for that.
Without putting you on the spot, do you have some examples of the lyrics that people try to enact with these purloined rabbits? Like, is there a specific, like, my father stole my rabbit and then went to the shops with it? Or my father put a funny hat and posed it for pictures? Or is it just the, my dad bashed a rabbit's head in and we ate for Christmas, but it was a sad dinner?
It was Christmas morning, 1961. I recall the empty pen where my rabbit pet belonged. And my mother told me, don't go in the shed. And if I just behave, then I'd get something yummy later on. After the soup, the main course would arrive. And my father laughed and pointed, look, it's Flappy in the pan. I still see the silver bowl and him lying in three pieces. And I realised my dad is such an evil man.
Oh my god!
The way you're, as you're narrating this, it sounds like a really earnest performance poem, like that we should all sort of be doing.
Yeah. I thought Fairy Tale of New York was dark. Yes.
You should hear what they call the rabbit.
Yeah. It already rhymes with it.
It does. I left the table screaming and stamping and cried on my bed for hours and hours, and I stood cursing loud at the top of the stairs, yelling, Flappy wasn't yours. I stared out the window with an empty rabbit pen on my mind. If McCartney was listening to this, he'd want to intercut it with some banging and crashing to make Carnival of Light 2.
Oh, great. Put it on his mixomatosis tape.
Hey. Oh, there it is. Frank Sinatra famously had very high standards about what he'd release. But in 1951, he appeared on his own show opposite a buxom hostess called Dagmar. And this quite unlikely duo, they had quite a chemistry. And so the songwriter Dick Manning penned a duet for them. He was responsible for quite a few novelty songs, Dick Manning. The more I say his name, the dirtier it gets. Dick Manning was the co-writer of many songs, including Hot Diggity and Papa Loves Mambo.
Okay,
so Papa does love Mambo.
But he wrote for Sinatra and Dagmar something called Mama Will Bark, which featured off-key singing by Dagmar and the sound effects of dogs barking in the background. According to one biographer of Frank Sinatra, he said, nobody brings Sinatra in the studio to do something that he doesn't want to do. And he had to give the right to okay its release. And Sinatra, he said of it, the only good it did me was with the dogs. One last one before I tell you my choice. I found a song called The Most Unwanted Song, which is created by Comar and Melamed and a composer called Dave Soldier in 1997. And they specifically designed it to incorporate the most annoying lyrical and musical elements. Any guesses on what they might be?
Unresolved cadences. Hemi-demi-semi-quavers.
I don't know music. I'm just assuming that it's a man banging and crashing, but we've had that with the Beatles.
Kazoos and Swanee Whistles.
No, that's Radio 4, 6:30 Monday nights.
Yeah.
They include bagpipes, cowboy music, a children's choir that urged listeners to go shopping at Walmart, and an opera singer rapping.
In an operatic voice?
Oh, yes.
Oh my gosh.
And he rapped a mixture of casual swearing and references to Wittgenstein. And whilst he rapped, the children's choir sang about various holidays, including Christmas, Yom Kippur, and Ramadan, and ended each verse with the line, do all your shopping at Walmart.
This sounds amazing.
Yeah.
The song ended with a performer letting off a bullhorn and shouting political phrases at the same time.
So Twitter in a song form.
Yes. But for my world's worst novelty song, we are going to go to America in the 1980s and the NFL. And I'm going to tell you about the Super Bowl Shuffle.
I think we've talked about it before. I can't remember when, but yes, this is good.
So in Britain, when I was growing up, a long tradition of the England and Scottish side recording songs when they went to the World Cup, or FA Cup finalists recording songs. And in 1986, the Chicago Bears got to the Super Bowl. However, 6 weeks before that, they recorded the Super Bowl Shuffle, led by the wide receiver Willie Gault.
There are some really good penis-based names in this podcast. Gosh, no. Hot damn.
A lot of the players didn't want to take part in it because they felt that it was going to be hubristic recording this song before they'd made it to the Super Bowl. And Gault said, listen, if you listen to the record, it doesn't say we're going to the Super Bowl. We didn't say we were going to win it. It said we were going to do a dance, and that dance was the Super Bowl Shuffle.
Oh, well, that's like really singing like the Champions League final rap. You go, we're not saying we're going to win the Champions League final. We're just singing a song about being in the Champions League final.
Precisely. Yeah, it's a little bit like when Muhammad Ali was doing beat poetry about knocking the other guy out. He's just like, oh, I'm just spitballing. I don't mean anything by it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their problem was that as part of the lyrics, they declared that their goal was to feed the needy. And therefore, it was suggested that the profits of the single would go to charitable causes in Chicago. The song gets recorded the night before they were scheduled to film the video for the song. They dropped their first game of the season, losing 38-24 to the Miami Dolphins. And the team showed up for filming the next morning in a foul mood.
Yeah.
One of the team, Walter Payton, who was initially supportive of the project, was like, no, I absolutely refuse to be on this single. The single sold well. It threatened to take Thriller off the top of the sales charts. It bafflingly got nominated for a Grammy for Best Rhythm and Blues Vocal Performance by a duo or a group. It lost to Kiss by Prince, which is like a relief all round. But the problem comes from this claim that they would feed the needy. It was particularly displeasing to the owners of the Chicago Bears, who were like, we haven't agreed to this. basically, if an NFL team had made this public announcement that funds were going to be pending, then the Chicago Bears needed to know how much and where they were going to be paid to. So they contacted Illinois Attorney General Neil Hartigan, saying, would 50% be permissible? And Hartigan went, no, 75% is the letter of the law. Meanwhile, the record label was like, oh, we were expecting it to be 15%, and we've invested a lot of money elsewhere. So this dragged on for another year. Red Label, the label, they claimed that the album returns needed to be calculated before they could estimate the profit. One of their linebackers got so angry, he threw his gold record from the sales into the garbage, saying, it doesn't represent an accomplishment. It doesn't mean a thing unless it gets food to hungry people who were supposed to be fed out of it. I thought it was a clean-cut deal. It's taken a year. In the end, $331,000 was turned over to the Chicago Community Trust. Good, but the 10 players with speaking parts in the song only made $6,000 each, and they sort of begrudgingly handed over the money to the charitable cause.
Everyone's coming out of this really well.
There were six players, including the guy whose idea it originally was, who filed a lawsuit in 2014 claiming they hadn't received additional payments from the merchandising and distribution connected to the video. And so they tried to get the money back. So even though it did give money to charity, it basically destroyed the goodwill in one of the top NFL football teams of the 1980s.
I will say there's a way to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And that is get a load of different singing groups and make them play American football for like a season.
Yes.
Yes. Just invert the thing. Okay, you're a bunch of American footballers. You're singing a song. Cool. Let's do it the other way around. Brilliant. Yes.
Yeah, the Pussycat Dolls versus Blazing Squad.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of bands that have nearly enough members to actually play American football.
Oh, shit, you could do an orchestra.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Set an orchestra against another orchestra.
Full concert orchestra.
Yeah, full contact, full concert orchestra.
They have to play holding their instruments, obviously.
Oh, God. Have we just invented, like, marching bands?
Yeah, oh, no, wait, you're right. We've invented marching bands.
Like sprinting bands.
Yeah, but they get to use their instruments as weapons as well. So using the double bass to fire the bows at opposition members.
Yeah.
I think we're onto something here. Like, we need to get in touch with Games Workshop or something and sort of pitch this as a tabletop, like, with miniatures.
Who invented chess boxing? I reckon if they got that off the ground, they could probably get orchestra American football up there.
Yeah, sportcastra.
Sportcastra.
The reason I chose novelty songs is because a large portion of my brain, the bit that's not run by puns, is occupied by novelty songs that just live it. And I don't mean like the fun and interesting, at least there's a bit of a beat or something that you can dance to, that kind of thing. I'm talking about the sort of novelty songs, particularly children's novelty songs, that were on the album's Junior Choice collections, one through God knows how many. It's basically a child's it's like, now that's what I call Nelly the Elephant. It's that kind of album.
I won't have a word said against Nelly the Elephant. When I was trying to improve my son's listening, I discovered that there is a cover of Nelly the Elephant by Sunderland-based punk band The Toy Dolls that is absolutely transcendental. They do it as an encore, so the way he introduces it is like a conductor about to introduce a work by a great artist. He's just like, ta, ta, thank you, ta. We would now like to play Nelly the Elephant.
So when this was recorded, feasibly, Nelly the Elephant tractor punk. Nope, that deserved nothing. That deserved nothing. Don't give me your pity laughter. If any listeners are laughing at this, don't.
No, it just...
You're wrong.
It just took a moment. The pun had a 3-second fuse on it.
Yeah.
So anytime we'd go on holiday, we'd always drive to places. We weren't a flying on holiday family. It was we drive to Wales to visit my grandparents and have a terrible time there, or we'd drive to Germany via a ferry. And it was either one of the many Junior Choice tapes or an audiobook called A Year in Provence, If you've not heard one of these albums, listeners at home, there's no artistry to how these songs are collected or arranged, and they're almost uniformly novelty songs released between the 40s and the 70s.
Yeah.
And novelty songs that were released between the 40s and the 70s, I've jotted down the sort of loose themes, which are as follows. I am an affable pervert. Through carelessness or inaction, I allowed a man to die. My wife is bad and yours is worse. I, a tradesman, am directly responsible for murder. And toothbrushes, but they fuck.
Can I just say, these sound like absolutely the worst daily affirmations I have ever heard.
Just sitting in front of the mirror. Through action or carelessness, I allowed a man to die. And I feel great.
My favourite thing about all, because the 50s particularly, it's just that the birth of rock and roll is being resisted so heartily by white middle America and McCarthyist mores. So it's just, you can feel Buddy Holly and the rest of them like at the gates of the city, and inside they're all sat down together singing, you know, how much is that doggy in the window?
Yeah, it's like, so skiffle was the point where everything branched off, and it either went to, you know, the Beatles, that kind of thing, or these weird twee songs about a boy and a fishing boat, or about Nelly the elephant, like Megan the stallion.
Yeah.
And obviously, the elephant in the room before it leaves, there's a lot of racist ones. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to touch those. Let's keep it light. Which I think was the title of one of the racist songs. Bernard Cribbins is responsible for a lot of these songs, and the majority of the songs that he sings are the I'm a tradesman that killed a man.
Yeah.
So the song Hole in the Ground, I don't not enjoy it, not gonna lie. It's a song about a man digging a hole. A wealthy man approaches, questions this gentleman's work ethic and his hole digging capabilities, and then the singer, our hero, kills the man and buries him in the hole. Not only has he committed murder and cheerfully sung about it, he's filled the hole in. Your job was to dig a hole. Presumably, that was required for something.
It's all about the class struggle, though, Guy. That's what it is. It's a socialist anthem.
And I do appreciate for that. The other Bernard Cribbins song, there's a strange kind of tragic beauty to it, is the song Right Said Fred, which is about a couple of blokes working in a removal company, trying to move something. They eventually take more and more and more bits of it, and that doesn't work. So they decide to take in the ceiling, which buries the eponymous Fred under half a ton of rubble. And then the singer and his pal have another cup of tea and then fuck off home.
So it's basically sort of like a gritty reboot of Laurel and Hardy, isn't it?
It's the pivot joke from Friends, but with Death and Bernard Cribbins.
And I realised the other day that now the actual band, Right Said Fred, that took their name from this, have taken a staunchly anti-vaccine thing. They're doing free PR for the coronavirus, which I'm not entirely sure why. But I realised with a grim chuckle that the song that they have named their band after, and the name that they still go by, is a song about preventable deaths occurring due to people not following even the most basic safety measures.
My favourite thing about Right Said Fred is that they jointly hold the record with the song I'm Too Sexy for the single with the most consecutive weeks at number 2 in the UK, with the Smurfs song by the Smurfs, another novelty act.
How does the Smurfs song go? Do you have any?
Oh, I don't know. It's probably like I'm Blue, I'm a Smurf Dabba-Dee, or something like that. the Smurfs song was held off number 1 in 1977 in the UK. It was number 1 in 16 other countries. It was held off number 1 by You're the One That I Want from Greece. What a time musically to be alive.
I mean, really, I would love it if the Smurfs had retaliated with You're the Smurf That I Want. Smurf, Smurf, Smurf.
I'll save my rant about the Smurfs for when it's my bit. Sorry, Guy. Continue.
Well, can I just say then, I'm going to get my punch in early. Obviously, you know how much of a music fan I am. The first album I ever bought was The Simpsons Sing the Blues, and I was quite amazed when I heard blues songs and like, why are you covering Homer Simpson, B.B. King? but the second one I bought, big music fan, like to think I've got good taste, was The Smurfs Go Pop. Thank you very much.
Okay, fine, Ben. You've said the magic words. I cannot hold myself back. My husband introduced me to the concept of Smurfs Go Pop last night when I was researching this. He said, I think he said it was the first album he also bought as well. I jokingly said, oh, presumably they'll have done all sorts of like punny remakes of songs. So they'll do like Smurfin' USA or I Would Do Anything for Smurf, but I Won't Do That. That sort of thing.
Wet Ass Smurfy.
Whatever, you know, Smurfin' Bird. That is basically what they do. They take pop songs, but they change the lyrics. But as he went through the song listing, I got increasingly furious at how poor or non-existent the Smurf-based puns were. So they released Smurfs Are Back. Do you want to guess what that's based on?
Backstreet's Back.
You would think so, Ben, but no, it's based on No Limit by Two Unlimited.
What?
And in a classic, you know, rewrite of lyrics, they changed no, 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 no to yeah, 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 yeah.
There is a limit. Know your place. We're the Smurfs.
Yeah, in fairness, they did Mr. Smurftastic, based on Boombastic by Shaggy. I've Got a Little Puppy.
That is I Want to Be a Hippie.
Yes, by Technohead. Mm-hmm.
I've Got a Little Puppy and I Want to Take Him Home. Pooper, Pooper Scooper.
That's unearthed a memory that I didn't know that was in the back of my brain.
You've just Manchurian Smurfed.
Yeah, that's
Guy
my
Kelly.
Phrase.
Yeah. The Noisy Smurf. It's based on It's Oh So Quiet by Björk. Why isn't it It's Oh So Smurfy? Or so? I just wanted to be root one with these puns. Find the Smurf, based on, of course, Love Is All Around by the Troggs and Wet, Wet, Wet. Smurfland, based on Living Next Door to Alice. Smurf Hillbilly Joe, based on Cotton Eye Joe. It's Cotton Eye Smurf, it's right there. And then you have Our Smurfing Party, based on Saturday Night by Wakefield. We're the Smurfs, based on All Right by Supergrass. And this one isn't a pun, but this exists. And long-term listeners of the show will know how much we hate Mr. Blobby on the show. You have the song Mr. Blobby and the Smurfs.
Oh, that's
Jesus Christ. Please tell me that is AKA the Axis of Evil.
Yeah, that's essentially it. So sorry, I just got so furious that the puns weren't the Route 1 puns I was hoping for.
Oh, it's a series of missed opportunities, but I will say that given the sheer size of the world and the number of people in it, Mr. Blobby and the Smurfs could have conceivably been somebody's first dance at their wedding.
Oh my God, that is
there is
so
a non-zero chance of that.
Grains of sand on the beaches, yep. Weddings big, around the world. Yeah,
big wide world. There's only a couple more things I want to say about sort of Junior Choice as a general collection of novelty songs before I rattle through. The one that I think is the biggest problem. I've just had a look on Amazon to look at a review of Junior Choice Volume 1. The top positive review, every track enjoyable. That's, you know, that's what you want. And then rated 2 stars. My daughter doesn't seem to enjoy listening to it either. Many of the songs are not really what I would choose for children. My daughter doesn't seem to enjoy listening to it either. I like that she's bookended it with my daughter doesn't seem to enjoy listening to it either. Like, that's there twice, beginning and end. Wow. And yeah, for Junior Choice, an album explicitly for children, the one thing that you'd want is a kid listening to it and going, yeah, all right.
A lot of these things, because Ben has obviously very good music taste, and you, Ben, are obviously, you have inculcated a strong musical aesthetic into your children. For example, your son really enjoys a bit of Bowie. But I feel like people who compile these albums for kids are going, children have never heard music. So we can just give them the most trashy, paint-by-numbers collection of sounds and assume they will love it. That's what the makers of these albums have done.
It feels like it's perpetually fixed in some sort of rose-tinted, never-quite-real Famous Five version of England. Like this weird frozen in time thing that never quite happened.
Yeah.
And it's all cheeky chappies and scamps and then the occasional legit good hobo song about the big Rock Candy Mountain. I will hear nothing said against
oh,
that.
Oh, that is
love a hobo
a
song.
Gorgeous song.
So before I get to my big thing, just a quick thing about Ernie, the fastest milkman in the West by Benny Hill. It tells the story, for those of you who don't know, it's about a quick milkman. The joke is, what if the Wild West but a milkman and his enemy's a baker? Ah. What I don't like about it is the ontology. I don't like the world that it suggests. And I don't mean, like, oh, there's a standoff at high noon between a baker and a milkman. That's too whimsical for me. No, thank you. Do your jobs, tradesman. That's not what I mean. At the end of it, spoiler warning for those of you who haven't listened to the song. It's not like there's an Ernie cinematic universe. It's a 2-minute song. Ernie, the fastest milkman in the West, dies at the hands of a baker. And the baker then marries the woman who was the sort of the hinge point of this love triangle. Ernie the milkman, Ted the baker, they both loved this woman. So because women are things, they fought over her. Ernie died, Ted married Sue. The song ends with a description of Ernie enjoying paradise. So in this world, heaven exists, milkmen go there. That's fine. I'm not saying that milkmen are inherently sinful. So it describes the paradise. Milkman's life is full of fun in this airy, dairy land, and it talks about dogs being nice and all of this. But then it talks about Sue marrying Ted, presumably quite a traumatised woman, because her lover was murdered, marrying the man that murdered her lover.
Yeah, she's Queen Gertrude in this situation. And in the Hamlet that is Ernie the fastest milkman in the West.
Something rotten in the state of Denmark. Yeah, that's the red top. It's been off for days.
And so Ernie leaves heaven and haunts his partner and his murderer. Is that the trees are rustling, or the hinges of the gate, or Ernie's ghostly gold tops are rattling in their crate? They won't forget Ernie. And that's said with a smile, but this suggests a world where the ever after, where infinite pleasures of the reward of a life well lived on Earth is an opt-out, opt-in thing. You'd be like, you know what, this is nice and all, living in actual paradise forever, but what I'm going to do is become a ghost to torment my stricken lover. And that's a weird world. Benny Hill, that's a weird world.
Yeah.
It's one for the kids, isn't it?
Yeah, keep it light, guys. Keep it light. And like the window cleaner pervert song, I go cleaning windows to earn an honest pop. That I resent the assertion, a window cleaner you would be if you could see what I could see when I'm cleaning windows. No, George Formby. I have more. I don't need to catch a glimpse of forbidden tit from a window to let my morals down. Don't suggest that just a small glimpse of flesh through a window is enough to turn me into a slavering ladder pervert. I don't. How dare you? How dare you? But that's not my choice. I should probably get to my actual choice, which seems quite tame, but I have reasons for it. My choice is Bangers and Mash by Peter Sellers and Sophia Loren.
I mean, there is a tainted couple, if ever there were one.
Actual actress Sophia Loren, actual comedian human Peter Sellers. And it's a song. It's a little tinged with xenophobia. Not as bad as a lot of the others, but it's a little. It's a song about, I think, an airman from World War II, working at, like, stationed over in Italy, falls in love, marries a woman, and now complains about her cooking to the extent that he releases a 3-minute song about it. And it's this sort of constant refrain of Sophia Loren singing about various agreeable pasta dishes that she may wish to make, and Peter Sellers' character saying, no, I would like some bangers and mash like me mother used to make. Mm-hmm. And as a song, as a piece of music, it's fine. What bothers me about this, to the point that I think it's the worst thing, is the pettiness of it.
Yeah.
Because first of all, if I was married to Sophia Loren, I'd just eat the fucking pasta.
Rice?
Not in a, like, lovely Sophia Loren, but you just eat the pasta. Pasta's nice. There's lots of different kinds.
She's probably cooked very authentically.
Yeah, home-cooked Italian food. And this is my problem with it. It's the crystallization of this weird aspect of the English character, this sort of, this longing for empire. The way things used to be, quote unquote. Give us a bash at the bangers and mash me mother used to make. No. You're not a child anymore. You can mash your own potatoes if you want some mashed potato, or your beautiful film star wife can cook you some tagliatelle. I know it's the 70s, and tagliatelle is weird and magical to you, but it's the pettiness and the sort of belief that's key to the darkest bit of the English character, that, oh, we're the bloody, oh, bloody best, aren't we? You're best of everything. Oh, all this bloody filthy foreign muck with my beautiful wife is cooking me because she loves me. No, I'm going to book out a recording theatre and fucking record a song about how much I loathe my wife's cooking and wish things would go back to how they were in the past.
I love that there is essentially a song that is which of these carbohydrate-based dishes is best.
Yeah. Is it the dry carbs? Is it the wet carbs? Oh, it's the dry ones because my mum made them. Diversify your palate, Peter Sellers.
I would go back to the Smurfs, but we have simply no time, as well as simply having no bananas. I want to talk about Yes, We Have No Bananas to begin with. And you know, the lyrics, yes, we have no bananas, we have no bananas today. We've string beans and onions, cabbages and scallions and all kinds of fruit, and say we have an old-fashioned tomato, Long Island potato, but yes, we have no bananas today. It was like a huge hit song, and it was written by a Jewish chap called Frank Silver. And he explained the origin of the song. I am an American of Jewish ancestry with a wife and a young son. About a year ago, my little orchestra was playing at a Long Island hotel. To and from the hotel, I was wont to stop at a fruit stand owned by a Greek who began every sentence with, yes. And so that habit, that vocal tic that this guy had sort of stuck with him, and he just put it into this tune. And so the fact that he said, yes, we have no bananas, they wrote a song that would make them like millions. It's only just come out of copyright like a couple of years ago. It's only just free in the public domain.
Fuck you, fruit seller. I'm going to take your vocal tick and become rich beyond my wildest dreams about it.
Not only that, but they were probably capitalizing on the fact that, yes, there was quite a worldwide crash in the banana crops due to the Panama disease, which was the most common disease to afflict bananas, and in the 20s it was particularly widespread.
And
so
I tell you what, after Brexit really hits, that song is going to make quite the comeback in this country.
Yeah. But the thing I love about this song is that in Belfast in October 1932 there were widespread protests which devolved into riots, and there were deaths as a result of these, protesting the arrangements for what was called outdoor relief. It was an unemployment benefit available only to unemployed married men considered fit to work who needed exceptional distress relief. So obviously that leaves out single men and the disabled and the ill and women and all sorts of people who weren't entitled to welfare in Belfast in the early 30s. And Harland and Wolff, the big employer, the shipbuilding company, had closed in the last decade. The number of people requiring this support had octupled in a short space of time. And so there were big demands being made of the city council, which ended up only in partial success at the end of it all. But outside the Custom House, on this evening of Monday the 3rd of October 1932, Catholics and Protestants together in a group of probably 30,000 protesters sang Yes, We Have No Bananas as their protest song, because essentially these were two quite strongly segregated communities, and it was one of the few non-sectarian songs that both communities knew.
I'm sorry, that's like finding out that peace in the Middle East broke out thanks to the Birdie song.
Yeah. It's the only kosher song they could find to sing. Speaking of Birdie songs, I've got a Donald Duck based song for you. In 1943, Donald Duck starred in Der Führer's Face, or Donald Duck in Nutsiland, an American animated anti-Nazi propaganda short film produced by Walt Disney, which would go on, may it be said, to win the Oscar for Best Animated Short at the 15th Academy Awards. And essentially, it depicts Donald Duck working in a Nazi munitions factory. He's got to get up very early in the morning. The town he lives in has like trees and windmills and clouds shaped like swastikas. He has to read a copy of Mein Kampf in the middle of it. He's carrying a bass drum in a German Oompa band comprising of Goebbels, Himmler, Hideki Tojo, Goering and Benito Mussolini.
Listen, at least that one is well cast, because one where they had Foghorn Leghorn playing Mao Zedong was just atrocious.
He's putting shells together on a conveyor belt and they get bigger and bigger. But intermittently, there are photos of the Führer come along the conveyor belt, and he has to heil them and all of these things. And there is a tie-in song that was written for the band Spike Jonze and His City Slickers, Der Führer's Face. Now, the version in the cartoon has tuba sounds and things, but the Spike Jonze version, he does like raspberry sounds to imitate Donald Duck sticking his tongue out and blowing a raspberry in the Führer's face. It got to number 3 in the US charts. Obviously, they were at war with Hitler. It is still odd to consider that a novelty song based around Donald Duck blowing a raspberry in the face of the most evil figure of the 20th century.
I just like the idea of two like American teens make out point in their car. It's night, like the sun has set, there's beautiful stars, and they're like the guy leans over and puts his arm around his date, and they turn the radio on and they're about to start making out, and then like number three in the charts.
100%. I also looked at another cartoon staple, Alvin and the Chipmunks, originally David Seville and the Chipmunks, or just the Chipmunks, a virtual band created by a guy called Ross Bagdasarian. And now Bagdasarian had created the song The Witch Doctor, you know, ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang, which he got two Grammy Awards for engineering on, because he uses the high pitch squeaky voices on that. That's from 1958. And he released the song under the name David Seville. And it was a big hit. Like I say, it was number one for 3 weeks. And so he recorded a follow-up song called The Bird on My Head, where he sings a duet with his own sped-up voice is the voice of the bird. And it also got to the top 40 in America. And then driving through Sequoia National Park, Bagdasarian saw a chipmunk dash in front of his car. And he went, this is the tie-in I need. And he created and voiced all three of Alvin, Simon, and Theodore in the Chipmunks. It's not different voice performers. It's him. And he also does the voice of David, their, in inverted commas, dad, in the original cartoon from the 1960s. And he named them, by the way, after executives at Liberty Records.
Great.
Alvin is named after Al Bennett. Simon is named after Cy Veronker. And Theodore after Ted Keep.
That reminds me of the story of, so the novelty record that I remember most as a child is The Purple People Eater by yes. Sheb Woolley. Great, it's got a nice little rock and roll lick and a good bit of backing. Do you know the excellent piece of trivia about The Purple People Eater?
I do. Is it about Finland?
It is about Finland. It was a hit around the world, but recently departed legend and keystone of British comedy, Barry Cryer, got to number one in the Finnish charts with The Purple People Eater, because for some reason it wasn't syndicated to that country under Sheb Woolley's name, so he was like, well, I'll record it then, I guess. Accidentally became a Finnish superstar.
A lot of people will know that song. Purple People Eater was number one in 1958 as well, the same year as the original David Seville song. It reached number 12 in the UK, topped the Australian charts. And according to Woolley, he pitched it to MGM Records and they rejected it, saying it wasn't the type of music they wanted to make. And then a copy of the song was just circulating in MGM Records office in New York. And the office's young people, who clearly had no taste in music, would just crowd around listening to it at lunchtime during their break. And the execs noticed and went, hang on a second, and reconsidered their decision and decided to release it. And what colour is the People Eater?
Purple.
It's not entirely clear that it is, because the lyrics are, I said, Mr. Purple People Eater, what's your line? He said, eating purple people, and it sure is fine.
Oh.
So he might be an eater who eats purple people, or he might be a purple people eater.
This does explain why there are no more purple people.
Yes.
Well, exactly.
Well, I will imagine the purple people eater watching the original Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and seeing Violet Beauregard be like, ho, 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 ho.
That's a banquet.
Yes.
It's funny you mentioned the song in the first place, by the way. The sped up voice thing appears in Purple People Eater, where they shout, we wear short shorts. And the Big Bopper synchronized these songs all together in releasing The Purple People Eater Meets the Witch Doctor.
Marvel Cinematic Universe before the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, wheels within wheels.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you say Cinematic Universe, I was thinking it's the Alien versus Predator of the rock and roll novelty single.
The Chipmunks released The Chipmunk Song, brackets Christmas Don't Be Late, in late 1958, which has Alvin wishing for a hula hoop, which is the hot toy of the year. It sold more than 4 million copies in 7 weeks and spent 4 weeks at number one over Christmas into January. Yeah, they won 3 Grammy Awards and a nomination for Record of the Year. And they even appeared with Bagdasarian and 3 chipmunk hand puppets on the Ed Sullivan Show lip-syncing along to the song. Yeah, and when he died, as I said, he did the voice of all three of the chipmunks and David. And then when he died in the 1970s and the chipmunks sort of came back into popularity in 1980 with their album Chipmunk Punk, a new series was commissioned by NBC called Alvin and the Chipmunks, which is the one we probably all saw when we were growing up. And Ross Bagdasarian Jr. takes over from his father as the voices of Alvin and Simon and David. But his wife, Janice, voiced Theodore. And I don't know why I find that so funny, but I find that inordinately funny. And he just didn't have the range of his father to do all three.
Darling, I've tried. I don't have a Theodore in me, please. You need to. But it was your father's dying wish. You must be all three chipmunks. I can't!
Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, first released by the Swedish artist Lil Babs in 1956, and then an English version was released in June 1960 by a 16-year-old called Brian Hyland. But we'll probably, given our ages, remember the 1990 version. Do you remember who sang that?
Was this Timmy Mallett?
It was the erstwhile kids' TV presenter and comedian Timmy Mallett, but actually it was under the band name Bomballerina. Do you know who Bomballerina is?
Darcy Bustle when she's gone rogue?
Bomballerina is what the name of one of the cats in Andrew Lloyd Webber's / T.S. Eliot's Cats. And why is that the name of the band? Because Andrew Lloyd Webber produced the single of Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini. And he did it because essentially his wife goaded him into doing it. She said as a composer of musical theatre, he wouldn't be able to make a pop song that would be a big hit. And so he decided to inflict upon us a remake of a novelty song from 30 years previously. And Timmy Mallett sang it alongside backing singers Annie Dunkley and Dawn Andrews. Dawn Andrews would go on to marry Gary Barlow from Take That.
As Guy has already said, wheels within wheels.
Yeah. But my choice of the world's worst novelty song is going to be How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? It's the, you know, the epitome of bland, safe opposition to rock and roll and jazz and all of the dangerous music of the early 50s and McCarthyism. And the same way that your song, Guy, said is typical of imperialist British attitudes. This is the, like, the safely, safely white America of the 50s theme song, as far as I'm concerned. The best-known version of the song was recorded by Patti Page in December 1952, released in January 1953 by Mercury Records. It really reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100, sold over 2 million copies. Excellent. Mercury didn't have a great distribution in the UK, so Lita Rosa recorded it for the UK charts, and it reached number one over here. And it made Lita Rosa the first British woman to have a number one hit in the UK charts.
Wow.
And so, as a Merseyside musical legend, she opened Liverpool's Wall of Hits on Matthew Street in 2001, Matthew Street being the home of the Cavern Club, the famed club where the Beatles played a lot. And on display were various discs from every British number one from Merseyside with the Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers and all of those. And the first one on the list, of course, is Lita Rosa's How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?
You've got to walk before you can run.
100%. And I love this for so many reasons, not least because Lita Rosa hated the song. In an interview in 2004, she revealed she sang it once, just one take in the recording studio, vowed never to sing it again, and in her entire live career, never ever sang the song. It went to number one, and obviously her record label were pushing her to perform it, and she just kept refusing. If that doesn't make you think, yeah, it's probably not that great a song, it'll also be unsurprising you to probably hear that in an interview with Smash Hits magazine in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher admitted that Lita Rosa's version of How Much Is That Doggy in the Window was her favourite song of all time.
Sorry, listen, far be it for me to ever defend the Iron Lady, but surely that is Margaret Thatcher being a pioneer in trolling.
I think it's her enjoying the free market of the shopkeeper having the freedom to price the dog however they wish. When Lita Rosa died in 2008, she left £300,000 in her will to charities, £190,000 of which went to Battersea Dogs Home, the Cinnamon Trust, and the Guide Dogs for the Blind Association. So fair play to her.
So we know how much the doggy in the window was getting.
Well, yeah, exactly. And to be fair, Patti Page, who also was recorded the original American version. The original version, by the way, included the sounds of dogs barking, which is credited as barks by Joe and Mac. Not dogs, but her arranger, Joe Reisman, and a violinist in the recording studio.
Great.
In 2009, she recorded a new version of the song with the title Do You See That Doggy in the Shelter? In the hopes of emphasising adoption is the way to go when it comes to taking pets into your home. And she gave the rights to that song exclusively to the Humane Society of the United States, I'm sure bagging them tens of dollars in the process. She said, the original song asked the question, how much is that doggy in the window? Today, the answer is too much. And I don't just mean the price tag on the puppies in pet stores. The real cost is in the suffering of the mother dogs back at the puppy mill. That's where most pet store puppies come from. And that kind of cruelty is too high a price to pay. And on her death in 2013, the Humane Society wrote, we remember her fondly for her compassion for animals.
This feels like one of those joke papers that a Oxbridge economist will write, like, how much is the doggy in the window and what does it mean for neoliberal economics in the 21st century?
100%.
It's really satisfying. As with many songs, this is one of my things I do to entertain myself in my frequent moments of lonely boredom. Narrating songs as if you're a frustrated German factory foreman.
Yeah.
Things like, you know, we are sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. But if you just narrate how much is that dog in the window in an increasingly frustrated German accent, it passes a minute.
Yeah. Well, the great thing I like about it is that the person in the thing is hoping to get a dog to distract her husband and keep him happy while he's away from her, so he obviously won't go sleeping with other women, is the undertone of the lyrics of the full song, if you listen to them. And I like I say, the reason I'm picking for the worst one is because the original recording artist thought that it merited re-recording and it was a mess, it sent the wrong message about animal rights. The original UK recording artist hated it and refused to ever perform it beyond the one time she recorded it. It was beloved by Margaret Thatcher, and I also found this story from 2014 in the UK. A pensioner, Susan Root of Coggeshall, Essex, who had a rare form of tinnitus, had spent 4 years having "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window" playing around and around and around in her head. Instead of having like humming or buzzing in her head, she could hear music, and the track that kept playing in her head was the Patti Page version of "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window."
I would stick a Black and Decker through my temple.
This is where it turns out like she had a metal filling and it was just a faulty radio somewhere, and all she needed to do was go to the dentist. Be like, well, I guess this is my life now.
But apparently she sometimes heard clicking or whistling, but by and large it was music. And after 4 years, you'd be glad to know it stopped. And was replaced with "Somewhere Over the Rainbow" from The Wizard of Oz.
That's nice. I occasionally get sort of phantom smells and things like that. I'll smell something that's just not there. But the idea of smelling "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window" for 4 years.
Guy, we are all married men and we've all used the phantom smells excuse.
So our candidates this week for the world's worst novelty song are Ben's suggestion of the charity car crash that was the Super Bowl Shuffle by the 1986 Chicago Bears, Guy's suggestion of Rule Britannia, aka Bangers and Mash by Peter Sellers and Sophia Loren, a match made in Hollywood heaven, and my suggestion of the song that its creators loved to hate, "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window." Excellent work. Genuinely, like, we've got like sports novelty songs, which is a whole genre in of itself. We've got celebrity duets, which I kind of love. And we've got kids' novelties, what's considered kids' novelty songs. Obviously, at the time, it was the cutting edge, most avant-garde musical style of its day.
On a sports novelty song and a celebrity novelty song note, I mentioned to my brother that I was recording this today, and he cursed me with some of the worst knowledge I've ever experienced, which was that Neil and Christine Hamilton released a football song.
Disgraced MP Neil Hamilton and his wife.
Disgraced wife.
His disgraced wife.
Two genuinely awful people released a football-based novelty song for some World Cup or other. He sent me a link to it, and as much as I love you both and admire this podcast, that's not research I'm willing to do. I've only got one set of ears.
The name of the song is "England Are Jolly D."
Awful.
It's a late entry, but it hasn't made the top three. Bangers and Mash, like you said, it's quite catchy, Guy. So it probably has, it kind of has that going for it. "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window," while I love the fact that the people who sang it absolutely hated it, and any song that Margaret Thatcher loves is an instant no from me. They did put a lot of time and effort into raising money for worthy causes and promoting animal rights and things off the back of it. It's also the first female artist to have a UK number one sang it, so, you know, it's got its place in history. Whereas the Super Bowl Shuffle has been on the show before. I do love sports stars being wheeled into a studio and made to rap / clap / step click along to terrible music, and the fact that it then has, and the fact that they are the greatest team of the 1980s pre the Miami Dolphins, and they are doing it for charity, but apparently nobody told them they were doing it for charity, and there's all the wrangling going on around it as well. I think I'm going to pick the Super Bowl Shuffle. Congratulations and welcome back to the 1986 Chicago Bears to the podcast.
It is. I'm amazed.
And before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week, and this comes from Denmark. In 2015, a Lego employee called Eric Ullerland Steyer had a passion project that he started.
Most of us call those affairs.
He started this idea with a Danish hospital where he would make Lego kits of miniature MRI scanners and scanning rooms, which he would donate to this hospital, that children would then be able to build and understand what they were going to undergo when they were having MRI scans. It's now taken off. The first prototype we made it with the Odense University Hospital, and they were using Lego, the Lego MRI scanners, to help over 200 children every year to understand what they were going to go through. And now the Lego Foundation has announced it is donating 600 Lego kits to hospitals around the world of this set that Eric Ullerlundster has designed to help them calm their nerves before they go into their MRI scan. The Lego kits, apparently, obviously they can be used to role play. They can help build confidence by reducing the stress. And as a result, it also reduces the use of the anesthesia that the kids have to undergo, because it reduces the stress and anxiety in advance of what can be quite a scary thing for a small child to be put into a large, noisy tube.
Yeah, MRIs are terrifying.
Yeah, I've had a few of them. As an adult, I didn't enjoy them. So yeah, 100 hospitals across the world apparently have already benefited from this.
Tremendous.
Lego continuing. I mean, obviously their output of plastic is not great for the planet, but in lots of other areas, well done, Lego. Before we go, Guy, where can people watch you stream and learn about you and read your occasionally inspired tweets?
So I'm horribly prolific on Twitter, at Brainmage. I stream Cryptic Crosswords at 1 p.m. or thereabouts, UK time every weekday at twitch.tv/brainmage. And can I be crass and promote my podcast, not to steal your listeners, because yours is good and has editing and mine has neither of those qualities. My wife and I are running a Garfield review podcast where we review every Garfield strip from the very first one in the 1970s up to the present day. We're releasing one episode per week, and if we keep out that output, which we haven't so far, that will take us 305 years. And
I have never wished for someone's immortality more.
What a curse.
Please tell me it goes out on Mondays.
Of course it goes out on Mondays. It's called I Don't Like Mondays. We've just started a Patreon for it. You can find it on all of the good holes that podcasts live in. It's really bad. It's unedited. There's no research. It sucks. Don't listen to it.
Lovely. And I presume that it opens with the sponsor for I Don't Like Mondays is Papa John's Lasagna.
Meanwhile, we're all off to stick Ben in the window of a pet shop and see how much we can get for him. Thanks for listening to The Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Don't have a waggly tail.